So this morning I got up, had some breakfast before I came down for the show, and I started looking at the local paper, and there was a headline, "Migrants Complain of Severe Hardships at Centers." And I said, my Lord, is the cosmos smiling on us? Meaning, my two guests today are talking about immigration issues and immigration problems. And here the morning newspaper and the content of the show go together. So I want to thank both you guys for whatever mystical thing you brought together that you brought the news with you. So let's get started. We have two guests today. Jeremy Slack, who's a professor at UT El Paso, who has been doing studies of the border and migration issues, and Dan Martinez, who's a professor here at the U of A and has also been studying border issues. The two of them have been working together for almost 12 years, or more than 12 years. Do I have that right, guys?
Yeah, that's about right. 2007, I think.
Yep, 2007. So that's a long time. And for us, that means also we have some experience. They've seen the ups and downs. They aren't just new to seeing things. They've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so what you're going to get is some nice seasoned commentary because of all the work they've done and also because the time they've spent at it. So let me start out with Jeremy. Jeremy, welcome to Tucson.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What brought you here? You didn't come just for the show.
No, my my wife's family actually lives here too, so we go back and forth quite a bit from El Paso to Tucson. I lived here for about 10 years, so it's always a pleasure to be back in Tucson. We miss it.
Perfect. I remember I asked Dan if Jeremy would know how to find his way to the studio, and he said, "Oh yeah, he's lived here before," so that worked fine. Let's start out with the paper, morning paper here. Migrants complain of severe hardship centers, and the article came out of El Paso, and that's where you live, and that's where you're working. Why don't you sum up for us what the conditions of migrants, asylum seekers who are arrested or who just want to be arrested, like asylum seekers, when they step over the border, what are their conditions? How have they changed?
Right. So, you know, one of the things that we've seen is an unprecedented increase in people applying for asylum over the past year. You're talking about 1-2% of the entire country of Guatemala crossing the border. Most, the El Paso sector being kind of the most active right now in terms of people being apprehended while they're seeking asylum. And this has led to overcrowding, as well as issues of mistreatment for what are called known as vulnerable populations, right? And so what we see is mentioned in this article, but has also been discussed for quite some time, is issues of young infants being held in crowded detention cells without access to food, formula, diapers. The big issue that was presented was there was a premature baby that was 1 month old that should have been in an incubator. Mother was 17. She gave birth early while she was crossing through Mexico. And she was held for several days in a crowded detention cell. And these are what's known as hieleras in Spanish, but the ice box in English. And essentially, these are short-term processing cells where people are only supposed to be a day or so. And they keep it around 50 to 55 degrees. So they're extremely cold. Most people have probably seen the pictures on the news of people with these, aluminum blankets, right? The kind you get for camping. And so we've seen up to 900 people held in these facilities that are supposed to hold 125.
You said they keep it at 55 degrees. Is that because of the heat in El Paso? Why would someone keep a place where people are at 55 degrees?
It's certainly a big debate. This is something that we've been debating and talking about for the last 10 years easily. The official reason is that they keep it that cold to prevent germs, but there's very little evidence to back up that claim that either raising the temperature would increase germs, increase disease, and keeping it low will prevent them. And in fact, what we've seen is people are so afraid to go back into these hieleras, these ice boxes with their children, that they're giving up a lot of their rights. They're not fighting against some of the different changes to asylum law that have happened, because they say to us, I can't take my children in there because they'll get sick again.
I just want to jump in real quick and just maybe we should take a step back and describe how what's going on along the border today is different than what was going on in the 1990s and 2000s. I think that's an important distinction that we should make, right? So today we're seeing an influx in Central American asylum seekers, people fleeing, you know, political instability, abject poverty, urban violence, and making their way north to the border to seek asylum. There are some Mexicans that are asking for asylum, but, you know, I would say that overwhelming majority are from the Northern Triangle, from Central America, Honduras, and El Salvador. Today, Mexican migration is the lowest it's been in, you know, since the 1970s. In the 1990s and 2000s, we saw a lot of unauthorized migration from Mexico, people who were economic migrants looking for work in the States, possibly trying to, you know, reunite with their family members. That era is coming gone. That's very different today. Now we're seeing it's asylum seekers that are seeking, you know, that are coming across the border, either at ports of entry to turn themselves in to ask for asylum or between ports of entry. So I think that's an important distinction we need to draw.
Which raises the question, why the shift? The decline in why the shift for both? A, the decline in Mexican crossings, and B, why now is the sudden dramatic Central American migration? Not just, let's say, I guess you can't go south because of the canal, not just revolution or protests, at least not that we read a lot about, but taking off either on your own, which is hard, or do we still use the word coyotes to pay to go all the way through Mexico just to get to the border? What's going on in Central America?
I can maybe take the first question about why we've seen a decrease in Mexican migration, unauthorized Mexican migration in the United States. And I don't know if, Jeremy, you want to take the second question.
Sure.
But demographers have talked about this for the last several years, right? The major reasons being is that Mexico is an aging country. Fertility rates are down. You know, the economy is improving, relatively speaking. And the cohorts of would-be potential migrants, you know, are no longer there in Mexico. They're here in the United States.
So yeah, everyone who wanted to come is probably here.
So I think that era of mass migration from Mexico has come and gone. Several sociologists and demographers have argued that. And I tend to agree with that position. I think just demographically speaking, we'll never see the same numbers of unauthorized Mexican migration as we did in the 1990s. So a lot of it is a demographic shift. Some economic explanations in terms of, you know, strengthening the economy in Mexico. And also, you know, we can't discount increased border enforcement and the criminalization of migration, right? You know, there is some research that suggests there is a small deterrent effect stemming from that. But I would say that the overwhelming majority is a demographic and economic explanation over increased enforcement.
If it's NAFTA, I'm not quite sure, but let's say NAFTA-like policies and consequences where Ford, Chevrolet, GM, Toys R Us, whatever, build factories in northern Mexico, and thereby has that contributed to higher employment rates in a strange sort of way? That is, you don't have to come to America for a job. America has come to you?
Yeah, I think one of the ways to think about it, too, is that NAFTA created a lot of adjustments to both the Mexican and U.S. economy. And a lot of the workers that left Mexico for the United States were essentially agricultural workers, right? These were people that had lived in subsistence agriculture, and that went away under NAFTA. And so we see this transition. People that are working in agriculture across the border work here, and then a lot of the people slowly were incorporated.
That was the historical past. Yes. What's changed, or who now picks California Central Valley fruits and vegetables if we've got a decline in back and forth Mexican agricultural laborers?
Well, I think this is something that's certainly going to be filled by Central Americans, but also, you know, we're even starting to see people from Nepal and Somalia taking a lot of those jobs, agricultural and, you know, slaughterhouse jobs, where traditionally Mexican immigrants were doing that. We see kind of that mobility happening as people who are now second generation Mexican immigrants improving, more education, higher fields. So more immigrants from other parts, right, are willing to do those really hard, tough jobs.
Central America, guys. What the heck change to drive people not just to revolt. Well, that's enough, of course. But,
sure.
But to make this long journey. And why not just stay in Mexico?
Yes, it's a great question. So, you know, we started to see this around 2014. This was this huge boom during the Obama administration of unaccompanied children crossing the border and families crossing the border, which was really a huge shift. This was very different. And not only were they crossing the border, they were asking for asylum. So these are, you know, often counted as undocumented or illegal immigrants, but really what they're doing is it's a legal right. This is a legal path to immigration. Is once you claim fear with an official, either crossing over the
asylum.
River, yeah, you're initiating asylum proceedings. And so we saw this huge boom. It decreased in about 2015, 16, 17, as you saw the Mexican government kind of doing more enforcement in southern Mexico. But also conditions being stabilized slightly. Over the past few years, we saw a huge dip with when Trump got into office. And I think a lot of that was people in Central America saying, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what this guy's going to do. I don't want to be the first one into that system. Now, a lot of those people that were waiting had since decided we can't wait anymore. And so we did see a huge spike up in people that were coming because a lot of those issues were still there in terms of gang violence, people being extorted. One of the things I write a lot about is why extortion itself is such a huge driver of migration, because not only do you lose your economic sustenance, right? Somebody starts charging your business a tax. I have a little, you know, I'm somebody in Central America. I have a little convenience store. Somebody's charging me $50 a week. Now they're charging me $100 a week. I can't pay it. I can't buy new inventory. My store shuts down. I've got no way to make money, and someone's trying to kill me. What's left? I mean, this is a really strong push.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to say that we can pinpoint one specific case or issue or situation that led to this out-migration, but I think it's kind of a cumulative, effect of, you know, it's an effect of cumulative processes that have been unrolling, you know, unfolding in Central America for quite some time. You know, going back to, you know, the civil wars in the 1980s, more recent, you know, coups in Honduras. I think there was a coup in 2009, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, led to a lot of out-migration. Obviously, the issue of Central American gangs, you know, extorting, as Jeremy was mentioning, extorting people, kidnapping people. I mean, the people are scared, especially young men. You know, if you're a young man in Honduras, your chances of being killed are quite high. Between the ages of 15 and 22, you know, you're at risk. And so I think, you know, a lot of people are fleeing, you know, this political instability, economic instability, and this urban violence and trying to seek a better life abroad.
Let's hold that thought, Dan, and we'll get back to you. We're going to take a break here with Jeremy Slack and Dan Martinez talking about immigration problems. Smart Talk, you're back. We're back on the air with Jeremy Slack and Dan Martinez, two sociologists from U of A and UTEP, UTEP. UTEP, yeah. UTEP. Oh, yeah. Yeah, University of Texas at El Paso. We're talking about their research on the border, problems on the border, and I want to ask both you guys, each one can take a turn if you want, what's involved in the new deal that Trump struck with Mexico, A, and B, why did Mexico accept it, and what do both sides gain or lose?
Right. I mean, this has been a huge debate and a huge issue. Essentially, Mexico really is so dependent on the United States, right? About 80% of their economy depends on some relationship to the U.S., either through tourism, oil, exports, manufacturing. And so this conversation with Trump that, you know, we're going to shoot the U.S. economy in the foot, but shoot the Mexican economy in the head was a real threat. And so what Mexico ended up doing is not only to agree to stem the flow of people in southern Mexico as they previously did to Obama, but to accept a new policy, which would essentially be to send asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait for their cases to finish, right?
This would be Central American asylum seekers. It's called the Remain in Mexico policy, right? Or the Migrant Protection Protocol.
So we're exporting the housing function of holding immigrants until their papers are processed to Mexico rather than have the iron cages, bad publicity, deaths, infants dying, on American soil that's generating this huge embarrassment. Is that fair to say?
Sort of. So before, what we would do is people would be held for a period, and then they would usually be released, right? People that have...
the family members in the
United States. A family member in the United States that's willing to sponsor them, which is the vast majority of people, and people that don't have any criminal record.
Old-time asylum seekers, we could call.
And right, new and so time. They would essentially go out and be able to work and, you know, usually work and pay for a lawyer and do their case in a normal immigration court. But now they're waiting in these cities. So the two ones that are being used right now, but it's possible that it will expand, is Ciudad Juárez and Tijuana. Both of those are in the top 50 most violent cities in the world. And so what now you have is between about 10,000 people in Juárez that are now being returned and waiting for their cases to adjudicate, as well as about 15 to 20,000 in Tijuana. And so these are a population now that is stuck in these cities with a court date on the other side of the border, trying to figure out how they're going to deal with this issue.
Let's shift to another topic. You guys have both done a lot of research, and I know Dan has here at the U of A about migrant deaths. And let me start out and just ask you, Dan. I think you've published some of this, but a lot of folks might know it. You and your research fellows have found a fascinating association between where in Mexico and maybe Central America, at least Mexico, you leave from to come to America as a migrant. And if you happen to die in the southern Arizona desert, how and where you die. And it's not something that people might suspect, but it was absolutely interesting what you found. Talk
sure.
to us about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so just to kind of provide a little bit of context, in the past, few people actually crossed through southern Arizona, right? Most unauthorized Mexican migrants coming to the United States crossed through either El Paso Juarez or through San Diego, Tijuana, those areas. A series of border enforcement initiatives in the 1990s essentially built up these traditional crossing points in El Paso Juarez and San Diego, Tijuana, and redistributed or funneled migration into southern Arizona. And that's when we started seeing a large increase in migrant deaths here in southern Arizona. Right around 2000 is when we really noticed a big jump. So in 2005, I started doing some research with folks in the Mexican American Studies Department here at the University of Arizona, as well as the Binational Migration Institute, reviewing medical investigator reports of migrants who tried to cross the border and died in the process. And what we ended up finding is that these death types tended to be patterned, right? So we saw among the people who had died, women were more likely to have died of exposure relative to homicide and motor vehicle accidents. Younger and older folks were more likely to have died in motor vehicle accidents relative to crossing through the desert. And really what this speaks to is the ways in which people facilitate their unauthorized border crossings, right? And so it has to do with the context that they're drawing on and the networks that they're accessing to try to actually cross the border. And so due to that I really got interested in learning more about people's border crossing experiences here in southern Arizona. As I mentioned before, there wasn't a lot of research on this area because people, you know, had historically crossed through El Paso Juarez or San Diego, Tijuana. And so that encouraged me to go down to the border and start surveying migrants who tried to cross the border, were apprehended by U.S. authorities, and then deported back to Mexico. And that's when Jeremy and I teamed up. This is back in 2007, and started doing these in-depth interviews and surveys. And to date, we've surveyed over 1,600 people who tried to cross and been apprehended and deported. And not just here in Nogales, but also in Tijuana, Mexicali, Juarez, Nuevo Laredo, and in Mexico City.
Okay, I'm going to jump in for a second. I'm going to ask folks listening to guess which of any possible number of reasons, once deported and you're interviewed by Dan and Jeremy, that you say you would take a chance to cross over again. Could be everything from, I like the place I was living, I make a lot of money there, anything you can think of. And the number one thing they found was?
Home. It's home. So what we did is, drawing on the second wave of the migrant border crossing study, we interviewed over 1,000 people about, again, their border crossing, apprehension, detention, and deportation experience. And we asked them in these surveys, do you plan on crossing the border again next week? And we also asked them, do you plan on crossing the border sometime again in the future? And we took into account a series of factors, right? both push and pull factors as well as enforcement factors, whether or not they were processed through Operation Streamline, which, you know, results in a federal misdemeanor or a federal felony charge for unauthorized entry or reentry, whether or not they were detained. So against the backdrop, when controlling for all these other factors, the single strongest factor driving repeat migration is whether or not their home is in the United States. And I'm not talking about like an address or whether or not they purchased a home. I'm talking about a subjective understanding of where your home is. Home is where you hang your hat, essentially, type thing, right? And so what we really found is it's the powerful pull of place is what was driving.
I think we forget that while we have a surge in recent migration of asylum seekers and perhaps traditional crossings, of the 10 or 11 million undocumented people living in the United States, many have been here for 10, 20 years, such that this is where the family is, this is where their children are, this is where they are. When at a stoplight crossing, the policeman asks for your papers, you don't have them, you, not the family, not your children, not your loved ones, get deported. And so it's no wonder when you think about that or think about yourself having being a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old to be deported and leaving your parents, your own children here. It's no wonder from that point of view that it's not the money. It's not I miss surfing at Malibu. It's actually your loved ones.
What we found in our, you know, among our respondents is among the people who had previously lived in the United States, on average, they had lived here something like 7 or 8 years, which is not that far from what Pew Research Center has found in terms of the average length of stay or residency among unauthorized immigrants, you know, in the United States, including not just unauthorized Mexican immigrants, but all, you know, all unauthorized. And so when we consider the fact that people are putting down roots here, they're starting families here, they go to church here, you know, they work next to us, they work with us, they're our friends, they're getting integrated into local communities. There's this place attachment that emerges. And, you know, overwhelming majority of unauthorized immigrants in the United States are decent, hardworking people.
So I mean, one of the things
I'm
going
to jump in for something else, sure. And you can both do it. So I could imagine my audience driving along, listening and saying, I hear you. My heartstrings are pulled. But I've also got to consider that they came here illegally. Mm-hmm. And so now you're asking me to weigh the passion story versus the following America's laws story. Where in your research or understanding do we talk about the legal, illegal part of entering, and what do you think we need to do about somehow bringing those things together?
Yes, I mean, you know, people don't like the idea of somebody cutting in line, right? People don't like the idea of somebody who is, quote unquote, taking advantage of a system. But one of the things that surprised me again and again is that people express to me, you know, I don't want to break the law. I want to come legally. But when it comes to this choice of not seeing my children, not seeing my family again, what am I going to do? And so this is, you know, this is something that we did night after night. We would do these interviews with people who'd lived here 10, 15 years and had their children, had their lives in the United States, people that almost died. And essentially what we saw is you can't punish that desire out of people. You can't punish the desire to come back to their families. And so we've seen, especially under Obama, this increase in charging immigrants with crimes, sending them to federal prison. And it doesn't seem to stop that will. What we really need is some sort of logical immigration reform, because the way that we have it set up now is these people are waiting 20, 30 years to try and get a legal visa to come.
Why are people coming without documents? Why are they coming without papers? Because it's so difficult to actually, you know, go through the legal channels in terms of, you know, whether it's the family-based visa sponsor system or employer-based visa system. I mean, it's very difficult, and you know, it's nearly impossible for the majority of the respondents that we've talked to, you know, working poor Mexicans from southern or central Mexico, earning on average, you know, $400 a month in terms of household income. For them, you know, trying to get a visa to come to the United States to work, either a family-based visa or employer-based visas, is essentially, you know, it's a one in a million chance, right?
I understand. We're going to move on. I just want to make one more comment. I'm sure some people are also thinking it's difficult to follow the law. Does that then justify people who break the law? Let's just, you know, I mean, we can go back and forth. Sure. Let's try and hit some more topics. And before we do that, we got to take another break. Here with Jeremy Slack and Dan Martinez talking about their research on the border. Stay with us. Smart Talk. We're back on the air with Jeremy Slack and Dan Martinez, two sociologists who have done a lot of research. They've worked together for the last 12 years on migration problems, ups, downs. I want to just finish off what Dan was talking about, the social characteristics of people who migrate and different ways that they experience death in the desert. As I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was something like the following in the most general terms. One, if you migrating more often from Mexico City, because there have been long traditions of that, you were less often picking a unreliable coyote to drop you off somewhere, and you had connections and ties, and so your chances of dying in the desert wandering around without water was lower than other migrants. If you came further south from Mexico City, did it less often, then someone would say, okay, here you are, you crossed the border, just go north and you'll hit Tucson, well, in 20 minutes. And then those folks wandering, getting lost more often, die. If you migrate from the near border, I guess, northern Mexico, the chances are slightly better. You might have regularly been involved in something like a drug trade, and so your chances of dying from gunshot wounds were higher. Do I have that right, or did I miss it?
It's really difficult because we don't necessarily have the denominator, right? We don't know. We can't establish a probability of death in the desert because we simply don't know how many people are crossing and from where. We can kind of use Border Patrol apprehension statistics as a proxy for migration flow, but it's really difficult to try to calculate a probability of death while crossing. However, among people who have died, we can see whether or not people with certain characteristics are more likely to die one way over the other. Yeah. So there's a difference. There's kind of a nuanced difference. But I do want to go back to the issue of you know, the coyotes, or, you know, human smugglers, what we call colloquially in Spanish, coyotes. Jeremy and I actually have done quite a bit of research on coyotes and coyotaje. And, you know, the trust that migrants build with their coyotes. In fact, we asked, we essentially did a customer service satisfaction survey with migrants, and we asked them whether or not they were satisfied with the services of their coyote and whether or not they would recommend their coyote to a family member. And so here's what we found. So among the 1,100 people that we spoke with who tried to cross the border, got picked up and returned, about 70% used the services of a coyote, and they paid roughly $2,500, you know, to the coyote to cross the border. We asked them whether or not they were satisfied with the services they received, and 75% said they were, in fact, satisfied with the services they received from their coyote. However, a much smaller proportion, only 45%, said that they would recommend their coyote to a loved one, right? So what's the disconnect here? So you can probably take a guess that what's the single most important thing driving satisfaction is whether or not you made it to your desired destination, right? So people are willing to put up, the bar for suffering is pretty high. People are willing to put up with, you know, long, dangerous crossing, hours in the desert, as long as they make it. So that really was the factor driving satisfaction. In terms of recommendation, whether or not they would recommend their coyote to a loved one, it was more about qualitative treatment. It's more about the experiences. But yes, I mean, obviously, coyotes matter. The type of coyote people draw on matter. The types of ties you have to that coyote, whether or not you know them personally, or they're from your hometown, or whether or not they're referred to, you know, you might not know them personally, but maybe a friend of a friend recommended them, versus just meeting somebody for the first time in a plaza in northern Mexico, right?
It's, I mean, almost like anything else in life. The more you contact,
it's all about networks
and people. Yeah, you know, absolutely. We got a caller, Ingrid. Welcome back.
Good morning. Somebody asked on your team there, asked earlier, why aren't people who leave Central America staying in Mexico when they get there? And I believe their response was, I don't know. I've said this before on the air in other settings, and it in around 2005, in the Duval Auditorium of the University of Arizona, there was a lecture. And toward the end of the lecture, the speaker said, it is our intention to Hispanize the entire Western Hemisphere. And that didn't get a very good reaction from the crowd. And the lecturer got became intimidating. And he said to the person who was actually speaking directly to him that, you, sir, need to be investigated. Well, you know, I'm beginning to wonder if there isn't some kind of pressure on certain kinds of people who are in certain situations to actually leave Central America and go to the United States of America to fulfill that that plan to Hispanize the entire Western Hemisphere.
Ingrid, that's a great question.
Very bizarre.
Ingrid, that's a great question. Let me turn it over to our two guests.
Sure. I mean, I would say that the first reason that people don't want to stay in Mexico is because they're typically migrating to be with family in the United States, right? And so this is the way migration has worked, both legal and illegal, is that you usually go to a community where you know people from where you are from who can help you get jobs.
Yes, right? find jobs and find housing, and you know, it's family reunification and just kind of ease the integration process, right? So it makes sense. Also, you know, it's the economy, the U.S. economy is much stronger relative to the Mexican economy. There are more opportunities. So for the same reason that a lot of people are making the decision to from Mexico to come to the United States in search of, you know, a better life, it makes sense why people are opting to not choose to stay in Mexico and come to the United States. With that said, there are a lot of Central Americans who do live and work in Mexico.
Yes, but one of the other issues, though, is that we forget that Mexico is also quite dangerous. And a lot of the work that I did was living and working in migrant shelters along Mexico's northern border. And what we would see is a lot of the Central Americans who are fleeing violence were also being targeted by Mexican cartels, as well as Central American gang members who were working for Mexican cartels, right? So a lot of the people that were involved in extorting and kidnapping Central American migrants were actually gang members from Central America that are on these trails. And so for many of them, Mexico does not meet the requirements of sufficiently escaping the threat.
Yeah, I think there's another way to answer Ingrid's question, and I think it's a fair way to. What percentage of the American population is Hispanic, now broadly defined? 30%?
No, it's about 17%.
Pardon?
17%.
About 17%. Yeah. And what percent African American?
About 12.
About 12%. Okay. So 17% is not that high, but it Hispanic or Americans from have become an increasing force and presence in electoral things and other kinds of things. So in some sense, I would understand if some folks talked about, you know, Hispanization, I've never even heard that term, as a kind of sense of just feeling a certain amount of empowerment that comes with, you know, having changed status a little. That's the basis for people migrating, et cetera, et cetera. That I would guess, is a reaction to it. I think what my guests have said as the foundation for migration is true. That plus people just having kids within the United States who have lived here for generations and generations, like the rest of us, you know, you could imagine occasionally some activists saying that, but I don't think that's the grounds for people leaving home.
So a lot of folks, a lot of scholars have written about this idea of the Latino threat, namely Leo Chavez, or the quote-unquote Browning of America, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
There's a misconception that Latinos are unwilling and unable to integrate into U.S. society, that they're not assimilating to U.S. society, and that's not the truth. That's not accurate whatsoever. We see that by the third generation, most Latino / Hispanic origin people speak English in their household, right? Latinos have some of the highest intermarriage rates among any ethno-racial group. In terms of, you know, in terms of education, in terms of language use in the household, in terms of integration, in terms of marriage rates, intermarriage rates, we see very high rates of integration. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're completely rejecting their, you know, Mexican identity. That's still a very important part of people's identities, but you can be both Mexican and American. And for a lot of people, you can balance both of these identities. And the reality is most Latinos by the second, third generation are integrating quickly into U.S. society. And what we need to do is we need to, look at some of the research that suggests, you know, that what are some of the pathways that help, you know, kind of facilitate that integration rather than this other approach where we're seeing, mass deportation, family separation, criminalization of border crossings. That's going to lead to, essentially, an underclass, a large Latino underclass who feels alienated or rejected by mainstream society, right? So, I don't know, Jeremy, if you want to mention anything or hop in on.
There's a quick line I remember once, and you guys can tell me, you know the statistics better than I do, but Hispanic American death rates in the military are some of the highest, meaning that they are participating and on the front line. As much or more than those. Let's jump from this to something else. Ingrid, thanks again for your call. So we got a few more topics we want to hit as we're rolling along here. As a sign of the quality and respect for our guests and their joint research, one of them, Dan Martinez, coming up on June 24th, pretty soon, has actually been asked to do a congressional briefing, and it's called Ask a Criminologist. And so, Dan, tell us about that. Why were you chosen? What do you think they're going to ask you, and what do you want to tell them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, a lot of my research that I do in criminology, on unauthorized migration, the links between immigration and crime. I carry out this research with a co-author who's an assistant professor at University of Notre Dame named Ricardo Martinez Schultz. He also happens to be my younger brother. So it's been pretty neat to be able to carry out this research together. And so what we're really interested in is assessing what, if any, is the link between immigration and crime, broadly speaking, right? And there's been 100 years of sociological research that has disproven the link between immigration and crime going back to the early 1900s. In fact, some scholars, a recent study, did a meta-analysis, so a study of studies essentially, that reviewed 50-some empirical articles examining the immigration crime link in the United States among immigrants that came here after 1990. So post-1965 immigrants, what does that mean? Latinos and Asians, essentially. And what we find is this really pretty consistent, robust finding in the literature is that there is no relationship between increased immigration and violent crime or property crime at the aggregate level. And in fact, we do see a negative relationship, meaning that increased immigration in some context does lead to decreased crime through this kind of immigrant revitalization hypothesis. Okay, so that's.
The longer you stay in the States, the lower your rate of crime compared to coming newer. That hypothesis, Dan and Jeremy may react to, but we got to take a break. So stay with us. Smart Talk. We're here with Jeremy Slack and Dan Martinez, two sociologists who've been studying the border, one from the U of A, Dan, the other from UTEP. That's University of Texas, El Paso, and that's Jeremy. Dan, in a couple days, is going to be going to Congress, and he's going to be testifying, and actually not so much testifying as the name of the little program is Ask a Criminologist. So the congressmen are going to ask Dan about his expertise about border-type issues. Dan, tell us some more.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning before the break, there's a pretty healthy body of research that has demonstrated that there's no link between immigration and crime. So there have been over 50 studies that have been published since the 1990s disproving the immigration crime link. So some of the research that I've done more recently kind of builds off of that. Rather than focusing on immigration and crime, our research focuses on sanctuary policies and crime. So what, if any, is the relationship between immigration, so-called sanctuary policies, and crime? And what do we mean by sanctuary policies? Sanctuary policies meaning that local authorities will not enforce immigration law or cooperate with federal officials to enforce immigration law, right?
Sanctuary cities that often get criticized.
Correct. And what do we find? We find, okay, this is based off of 30 years of data. So from 1990 to 2010, right? No, it's 20 years of data. 20 years of data. We have another project that's 30 years. 20 years of the data, 1990 to 2010, we looked at 107 cities in the United States with populations of 100,000 or larger. And we were able to do, you know, look at change over time. And we were able to look at whether or not, what the relationship is between implementing a sanctuary policy and violent crime rate. And what we found is there is no relationship between the implementation of a sanctuary city and a sanctuary policy in a city and homicides. So there's no relationship whatsoever. Robbery, we actually see a negative relationship. We see cities that pass sanctuary policies have a decrease in robbery rates in subsequent years. So that's that's a finding that we find based on 20 years of data across these 107 cities in the United States. And there have been other studies that have found very similar results. How does this work? Why do sanctuary policies increase public safety? It has to do with a spiral of trust. It has to do with immigrant communities willing to cooperate with law enforcement investigations, willing to report victimization. All those factors help increase public safety, right? And so when you have local officials who are engaged in, immigration enforcement, that decreases the likelihood that people are going to want to, call the cops if they're victims of crimes, right? So if you can increase that trust between local law enforcement and immigrants, that's a good thing. And so some of the research, more recent research that we've been doing, Ricardo Martinez Schulte and I have been doing, we actually are testing this hypothesis to see whether or not cities that pass sanctuary policies see an increase in violent victimization reporting by Latinos. And in fact, we do see that. We see that cities that pass these sanctuary policies experience an increase in the Latino community willing to cooperate with law enforcement in their investigation. So that's what I'm going to be talking, talking in D.C. That's what we're going to be briefing Congress on, sanctuary policies increase public safety. And how does, through what mechanism? It's essentially by increasing people's likelihood that they'll cooperate with law enforcement investigations.
That's really important because there's so much out there on the air about the danger of sanctuary cities. That San Francisco person who was sent back, or supposed to but wasn't, and found the gun, got the gun, shot the tourist young lady. It gets talked about over and over again, but the data shows sanctuary cities, 30 years of data, your homicide rate stays about the same.
Homicides don't change, robberies decrease.
Yes. Robberies decrease, and the Latino community is more and more willing to cooperate with the police. Jeremy, I'm going to jump to you.
Sure.
You've got a book.
Yes, I have
Deported
a book coming
the Deaf, out. University of California Press. Tell the folks about it.
Yeah, so this is a book that's based off of kind of my research as well as Dan's research in terms of, we were doing a lot of these surveys. We were down in Mexico talking to people about their experience. And this was right around the time Mexico started its drug war. And so we started to hear crazy things from people, being kidnapped, being used as decoys for trafficking drugs. Someone was gunned down one night when we were interviewing people at the shelter. And I got really interested in this question of what does it do to remove hundreds of thousands of people to these cities that are experiencing such violent conflict. And so this book is essentially me living and working in shelters up and down the U.S.-Mexico border about people's experiences navigating that world where drug trafficking has become so powerful, so prevalent, and where the use of migrants as a cash machine, people that are kidnapped and extorted, but also as a way to recruit them into labor, has become extremely common. And so what I found is that, first of all, removing people, deporting people, isn't a simple equation of sending them home, right? As we were talking about earlier, a lot of these people have been gone so long, they don't know anyone in Mexico anymore. But what we're doing is, say someone from Tucson, they decide to drop them off in Detroit, Michigan, right? This is a long way from home. How do you get there? What do? We see people being dropped off without documents. They don't have a way to get a money transfer. They don't have a cell phone, so they might not know the
telephone numbers anymore. Losing all their documents is a big problem in Mexico. And so you see people essentially on the streets of these cities that are extremely violent, extremely dangerous, and there's a lot of people there that want to harm them, want to kidnap them. And, you know, the horror stories that come out of that are really terrifying.
Oh, I bet. I bet. Dan, do you got any comments on the research? It sounds like it's obviously negative, just like almost all the stuff we've talked about. In fact, speaking of that, is there any upside or positives on the immigration, migration, border thing? It seems like everything we've heard is negative. I'm not trying to be Pollyannish here, but I guess maybe I am.
It's a good question. I mean, you know, I think that what we were talking about earlier, the strength of people and the resilience,
amazes you.
Something that always impressed me, that people are willing to risk their lives and go through so much to support their families, to work hard. You know, these aren't people that want to get on the government dole, take welfare. These are people that are pushing it to be able to work and have the same rights as everyone else, be able to support their family, live with their family, provide, work hard. You know, they have those American values really deeply ingrained in them.
The president's characterization of migrants as some of them, rapists, murderers, et cetera, evidence, data that you guys have seen or known says...
Yeah, there's no relationship between increased immigration and crime in the United States. In fact, there's research by a sociologist, Michael Light, at University of Wisconsin Madison, showing that you know, there's no relationship between even unauthorized migration and violent crime.
And Mexico exporting individuals who are rapists, murderers, gang members.
So there's individual cases of this happening. Obviously, you turn on the news and you see these cases. However, when we look, you know, at aggregate numbers, when we look at the overall picture, that's not necessarily the case, right? We can turn to any group within society and say, you know, and find examples of cases where people have committed, you know, horrible acts of violence or whatnot, but they're not the norm.
So yeah, in my experience, like Dan said, there's individuals who've committed crimes. In any population of people, there's going to be individuals who've committed crimes. A lot of my time that I spent living in these places, I'd run into people that had some serious criminal past. And what I almost invariably found is these are people who's had a very U.S.-based perspective on the world. These are people that often came as very young individuals, grew up in a difficult neighborhood, in an inner city environment where crime was prevalent, where gangs were prevalent. And a lot of times they had that mentality and had been sucked into those issues from a young age. Really the idea that Mexico is exporting their criminal population here doesn't have any basis in fact. And in fact, a lot of the work I did with drug smugglers was also enlightening on this is, the people that carry the backpacks through the desert, they're not going to the U.S. They're going back to Mexico because they can't pick up that check unless they get back to the place where they picked up the drugs, right? And so they are crossing the line, dropping off a backpack, and then they're headed straight back to Mexico, right? And so this is a very circular group of people. Often they're children, teenagers that are involved in this. And most of the people involved with criminal that are Mexican nationals, they need to get back to Mexico to get that money.
Now, that's fascinating. I'd never heard that. So, well, it's just fascinating that coming for drugs is that you've got to come back to get the money. So,
yeah,
I'm not saying people should be in the drug business to have people go back, but it's
a reality, right?
You know, that kind of speaks to, you know, there's two sides of this equation, right? I mean, we also have to consider, you know, the demand for drugs and narcotics in the United States. You know, who's fueling that demand? We have to think about the structurally embedded demand for immigrant labor, not just low-wage labor, not exploited, but there's certain qualities that immigrants bring with them, willing to work overtime, willing to work graveyard shift, willing to work weekends,
holidays,
you know, making sure you work hard because you want to save face with whoever got you the job. You might be undocumented and you don't want to you know, spend that social capital. I mean, so we also have to look at this as you know, is from both sides, right? It's not just a, you know, out there problem or issue, right? Immigration is involves both the United States and Mexico and Central America. And we need to, you know, especially in an increasingly globalized world, we need to better understand that we're in this together. These issues aren't going to go away, and we need to forge ahead and blaze a path forward where we work together with both Mexico as well as the countries in the Northern Triangle.
Will the Mexico and the United States recent agreement signed slow migrant numbers?
Most
quick yes. We're down to a minute.
Maybe in the short run, but I don't necessarily think that you can just cut off the southern border between Guatemala and Mexico. Asylum seekers are essentially fleeing this instability in Central America, this violence, abject poverty, and asylum has been an escape valve for a lot of folks. We cut that off, I think there's going to be some serious problems in Central America that are going to directly affect
the United States. And it could also disrupt Mexico, right? So what we were talking about earlier with the improving economy in Mexico, if Trump isn't satisfied with these changes and those tariffs go in, then we could see a lot of Mexican immigrants joining that group of people again, and we could see the situation worsened exponentially.
Fascinating. All right, we are at the end of the show. I want to thank Jeremy Slack from UTEP and Dan Martinez from the U of A School of Sociology for coming.
Thank you,
in.
Al. It was great being on. Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there tomorrow.
Everyone. We're both new fathers, so
yeah,
fantastic. All right. For Smart Talk, this is Al Bergeson. See you all next time.
Thanks.